Okay, let's go ahead and get started. Good afternoon, everyone. This is a rulemaking hearing concerning campaign finance rules. We are meeting, just for the record, the date is July 1st, 2008, and the time is 2:08 p.m. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room on the second floor of the Secretary of State's office at 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado, 80290. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State. I'll conduct the hearing on behalf of Secretary of State Kaufman. The other people at the table with me, to my immediate right, is Secretary of State Mike Kaufman. To my far right, Monica Marquez, Assistant Attorney General for the Department of Law. To my immediate left will be Andrea Geiger, legal specialist with the Department of State, Secretary of State's office. And then to my far left is Christy Hebbard, who's with the campaign finance and, well, with the elections division of the Secretary of State's office. The purpose of the hearing today is to receive public comments concerning proposed rules relating to campaign finance. I'd like to give a little bit of background about the proposals that are the subject of today's hearing. There's really two different sets of proposed rules. One set is a set of proposed amendments from the Secretary of State's election staff. These proposed changes were the subject of a notice of rulemaking that was issued on May 29th and published in the Colorado Register on June 10th. At that time, there was an initial draft of the rules published, and then last week on June 26th, the Secretary of State's office published an updated draft of the proposed amendments. And copies of the notice of rulemaking, a proposed statement of basis and purpose, and the June 26th draft are on the table by the entrance door. So we will be working off of the June 26th draft today. In addition, there is also a proposed rule change requested by an outside party. On June 18, 2008, Attorney Scott Gessler, on behalf of the Colorado Federation of Republican Women, submitted a written request to the Secretary of State for the adoption of rule language that concerns the circumstances under which certain Section 527 political organizations are required to report contributions and expenditures to the Secretary of State. Under the state's Administrative Procedure Act, outside parties can request rules, and since the Secretary of State already had this rulemaking hearing scheduled, the Secretary of State chose to go ahead and include the proposed rules from the Colorado Federation of Republican Women as part of today's rulemaking hearing. Again, on the table by the door, there is a set there's a copy of the notice of that rulemaking together with a copy of the formal request for rulemaking. And I should mention also that part of that request was not only for the adoption of a proposed rule, but also for the Secretary of State to request a formal AG opinion on the same subject. And our office is working with the Attorney General's office on a request for a formal AG opinion. With respect to the proposed rule amendments from the Secretary of State staff, I'd like to just briefly, for the record, explain just a little bit more about why those rules are being proposed. There is, I'll just work through the rules as they appear on the June 26 draft. There's basically four changes that are proposed by the Secretary of State's staff. The first proposed amendment relates to some changes to Rule 4.21. 4.21 concerns disclosure of contributions by limited liability companies, and the proposed changes that are before us today are the result of changes to the statutory provisions that were made by legislation this year, House Bill 08-1233. So we're simply trying to conform the rules to the legislation. The second proposed change is the repeal of Rule 6.4. 6.4 deals with alleged violations by Section 527 political organizations. This rule was originally adopted last year to fill a gap in the law. The General Assembly last year had adopted a statute requiring reporting by 527 political organizations, but there was no enforcement provision. So last year the Secretary of State adopted a complaint procedure to address alleged violations. This year, however, the General Assembly adopted House Bill 08-1041, and it addresses that gap in the law. So the proposal here is to repeal Rule 6.4. The third change is the adoption of new rules 10.5 and 10.6. These would be additions to Rule 10, which concerns recall elections. These two amendments are intended to clarify the filing deadlines for issue committees and political committees. The Secretary of State's office has been getting questions about which filing deadlines apply to issue committees and political committees, and that's the purpose of those two rules. And then finally, there is a proposed new Rule 13, which deals with personal financial disclosures. Under the campaign finance law, candidates are required to file personal financial disclosures. These proposed changes are intended to address some questions that have arisen about whether or not those disclosures have to be full, complete personal financial disclosures, or is it sufficient to file an updated personal financial disclosure in the case of candidates that have previously filed a personal financial disclosure. So those are the proposed rules from the Secretary of State staff. And I next want to basically just turn to public comment on the proposed rules, including the rule proposed by the Colorado Federation of Republican Women. I think it might be helpful, perhaps first to call upon Scott Gessler on behalf of the Colorado Federation of Republican Women so that they have an opportunity to explain the basis for their request for rulemaking. Then I'll proceed to call on people that have signed up on the sign-up sheets for further comment. And again, if anybody wishes to sign up that has not yet signed up, please do look at the sign-up sheets on the table by the back door. So with that, Mr. Gessler, if you'd like to come forward and identify yourself and who you represent and give us your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hobbs. My name is Scott Gessler. I'm with the law firm Hagstaff Gessler, and I represent, in this matter, the Colorado Federation of Republican Women. And I'll talk a little bit today. I'll try and keep my comments brief, but I'll basically reiterate some of the points that we made in our request for the rulemaking, explain a little bit more about the basis for this, and then perhaps provide an introduction as well to some of the additional comments you may hear. And then I'm happy to answer any questions either during or after my presentation. Again, I'll try and keep it short. Basically, this request for rulemaking stems from ultimately concerns on the behalf of the Colorado Federation of Republican Women as to the scope and the implementation of the statute that was passed by the General Assembly regulating political organizations as defined by the IRS. Basically, CRS 1-45-103, REN 14.5, it defines a political organization as an organization that's engaged in influencing or attempting to influence the selection, nomination, election, or appointment of any individual to any state or local public office in the state, and that is exempt or intends to seek any exemption from taxation, basically under Section 527 of the Internal Revenue Code. So basically, subsection 14.5 is modeled, the language is modeled after the IRS code, Section 527. It uses the key term engaged in influencing or attempting to influence the selection, nomination, election, or appointment of any public office. And the challenges that the Colorado Federation of Republican Women in particular has is in applying and understanding what the term influencing or attempting to influence means. The Colorado Federation of Republican Women essentially does a wide variety of activities. It ranges from charitable activities, activities that in one way or another could be described as political, whether allowing candidates to speak to members of the Colorado Federation of Republican Women, holding an event prior to the Republican State Assembly, or getting the word out among their membership of Republican issues and Republican candidates. In fact, they were advised themselves to register as a 527 organization by the National Federation of Republican Women. In fact, has registered as a 527, as has the state, the Colorado Federation of Republican Women. The Colorado Federation of Republican Women consists of a variety of subchapters as well, each one of which is its own freestanding organization that's affiliated with the state chapter. And each one of those meets the criteria for registration, or I should say for regulation, under Section 527 of the IRS Code. The problem is that the term influencing or attempting to influence can have a variety of meanings, and trying to identify exactly what this means, it seems to be, it's very vague. I have been asked a variety of questions as to what activities have to be reported and which ones don't have to be reported, and I've not been able to provide satisfactory answers either for myself or for them, my client, as to exactly what activities have to be reported, what types of contributions have to be reported, what in fact is influencing or attempting to influence the election. So that's sort of the how we wound up here. We, as the Secretary of State's office is maybe aware, we asked for an advisory opinion with respect to the specific circumstances of the Colorado Federation of Republican Women. That was a pretty extensive request, and after conversations with the office, decided to request this rule to avoid future ambiguity and to clarify what's going on here. With respect to the term influencing or attempting to influence, the legal framework that we approach it from is that unmodified, without any restricting language, this is an unconstitutional regulation upon the activities by the Colorado Federation of Republican Women. In the campaign finance context, the exact same language was struck down, or I should say was modified, by the U.S. Supreme Court in Buckley versus Vallejo. That's a little bit over 30 years ago, in 1976. And they basically said, in order to avoid constitutional violations, the term influencing or attempting to influence the election has to be construed as words that expressly advocate the election or defeat. Those are sort of the magic words test we have, vote for or not vote for someone. A few decades later, the court in FEC versus McConnell allowed the Congress to regulate what are called electioneering communications, unambiguous references to a candidate. However, since then, that term has even actually been whittled down by both the Supreme Court and the Colorado Court of Appeals in our local context, and that is only can the state regulate language or communications that are the functional equivalent of express advocacy, and that was obviously most recently in Wisconsin Right to Life versus FEC, Federal Election Commission. So the term influencing or attempting to influence has been substantially limited by court opinion. Now, in the context of the IRS regulations, 26 U.S.C. 527, the term influence and attempting to influence has not been resolved by a court. There's been one lawsuit brought. The lower court, the trial court, struck down Section 527 as an unconstitutional infringement. The appellate court vacated that order and basically said that court could not reach the merits because of the Anti-Injunction Act. So for a variety of procedural reasons, the circuit court indicated in its language that Section 527 was likely constitutional. I say likely because it didn't rest its opinion on that. In exchange for a tax break. Basically it said that the taxpayer here gets a tax break under 527, so they have to, and it's a self-designated, so they have to report. But they didn't really reach that. So it's, I think, an open question under 527. In any event, in Colorado, the term influencing and attempting to influence is within the campaign finance laws. It's not part of the tax code. It's part of the campaign finance laws. And so it has to be supported by campaign finance regulations and rationales. And under that, it seems to be unconstitutional. What we're asking for is an interpretation of the term influencing or attempting to influence in a way that makes the that makes this language constitutional. And the way to do that is to define that phrase, influencing or attempting to influence, in ways that the court has approved. And that is specifically two instances. One is express advocacy, and two is an electioneering communication that is the functional equivalent of express advocacy. Now, this court has already, I'm sorry, Secretary of State's office and its rulemaking. I'm used to being in front of courts. The Secretary of State's office has already limited the term electioneering communication to only those communications that are the functional equivalent of express advocacy. Because you've already made that limitation, our view is if you limit the term influencing or attempting to influence, as used in Colorado law, to express advocacy or electioneering communications, that would solve these constitutional infirmities. So that's basically what we're asking, and that's the legal framework. I would note in the legal framework that even the more recent cases by courts seem to reinforce a relatively restrictive view on the campaign finance laws. Recently, we had the case Davis versus Federal Election Commission that struck down the Millionaires Amendment in federal law, okay, in which the court applied strict scrutiny in that instance. Although that doesn't necessarily directly apply here, it does provide a tenor of the approach of the courts to these regulations of First Amendment rights. And then also in the Hooter Education Association versus Rutt, that was a Colorado Supreme Court case, in which the court there said essentially, as I read it, that any regulation, if you interpreted any communication, if there was a reasonable interpretation other than expressly advocating or interpreting it to be a contribution, if there was another interpretation, it was not regulated. That's a very rough paraphrase for the Hooter Education Association. But I think that shows that both in the state and on the federal level, there's a real concern about overreach here. We think that the Secretary of State obviously should take those concerns into account by restricting exactly how this particular statute applies. What you'll probably hear today is from a variety of people within the Colorado Federation of Republican Women who actually have to apply this on a day-to-day basis. And I think what you'll hear from them are two themes. One is the ambiguity and difficulty they face in determining what contributions, what expenditures may or may not, quote, influence or attempt to influence an election. Something as harmless as a meal payment to the Colorado Federation for Republican Women for a meal perhaps could be construed as influencing or attempting to influence an election if that meal hosts a candidate, for example, who's asking for votes or asking for support, or if during that meal they discuss Republican efforts or Republican ideas or Republican get out the vote goals or efforts. So it could be truly extremely broad. So the ambiguity is the first challenge. The second challenge is the burden that this places on a lot of these clubs. I didn't write this in the letter, but there's a couple things that should be noted, and I would hope that the Secretary of State's office takes this into account. The difference between Section 527 and this particular statute that Colorado has passed, basically requiring reporting of contributions and expenditures by a 527 organization if those contributions or expenditures are $20 or more. First of all, on the federal level, any organization with activity of $25,000 or less is not required to do any reporting whatsoever to the state level. I think what you'll hear is that there are a lot of local clubs within the Colorado Federation of Republican Women whose activities are less than $25,000 a year. So they're not required to report under Section 527, although they're regulated under 527. They're not required to report under 527 because their activity is so slim. Or meager, I guess I should say. And I would point out that, you know, ultimately the rationale for campaign finance regulations is to prevent corruption and the appearance of corruption. And that's viewed as quid pro quo or concentrations of wealth that create undue influence. And however we define concentrations of wealth, I think that clubs that have less than $25,000 of activity a year can hardly be seen as concentrations of wealth that unduly influence elections. So that's the first difference. The second difference is on the federal side, under 527 law, you're only required to actually itemize contributions, the names and addresses of contributors, if they make a contribution of $200 or more. In Colorado, it's $20 or more per reporting period. So what winds up happening, and I think you'll hear that there's a concern, and in fact, people have dropped out of the Colorado Federation of Republican Women, because they're concerned about invasion of privacy. They pay some modest membership dues to an organization that they support, and suddenly their name and address is posted on the internet for anyone to see. So that's another burden. And then finally, a lot of the people who are involved in Colorado Federation of Republican Women, at least a number of them, aren't interested or don't have ready access to the internet and to hiring or retaining a lawyer like me on an hourly basis to interpret, to file electronically, to download these masses of regulations and understand what's going on, or to hire me on a regular basis to be able to advise them on every item. And so that's burdensome as well, just from a logistical standpoint. Tracking, reporting, keeping the stuff, reporting it to Secretary of State on a regular basis, or facing what truthfully can wind up being pretty heinous and extreme fines that people have to pay. So for these reasons, unless an organization is expressly advocating or making election communication that's the functional equivalent of express advocacy, we don't think there's a constitutional basis for regulating it. That's why we're asking for this particular interpretation. And we also think from a practical standpoint, it's a particularly onerous regulation that's applied to organizations and people that, first of all, certainly don't corrupt the political process or create the appearance of corruption, and that this law, I'm assuming, I could be wrong, but was unlikely to capture. If I remember correctly, during the hearings on this law, there was particular concern about negative advertising and about rich organizations skewing the political process. That's not what's happening here. It's not close to what's happening here. But this group in particular has been caught up into this. I'll finally end with one last point. And this, again, goes to the dilemma that the Colorado Federation of Republican Women faces. Without this regulation, they're faced with a couple challenges. One, should they continue to lose members, or certainly lose members they could otherwise have, by being required to do all of these filings, so they would do full implementation and simply take a belt and suspenders approach and file everything and deal with those burdens. That's one option. A second option is to take their own interpretation of what influences and what doesn't influence election, and they would face perhaps a hostile private group that files a campaign finance complaint against them. I don't think it's any surprise that political enemies regularly file campaign finance complaints against other political enemies here, and there are people who not like to see Republicans get elected. I know that may be a surprise to some folks in the room, but essentially it creates a risk where the Colorado Federation of Republican becomes a target for organizations that want to file, organizations or individuals to file complaints against them. That's a second option. A third option would be to instead take the offensive and simply identify other organizations that are similar to them, that are not doing 100% reporting of everything, and file complaints against them, and we throw it into the administrative courts, or, of course, file a constitutional suit against the Secretary of State or the State of Colorado or both to try and get this overturned. None of those are attractive options. The goal here from the very start has been to try and get some clarity and some guidance here without having to go through extensive legal maneuverings, and just so that the Colorado Federation of Republican Women can go about its business as it always has without facing undue regulations. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, but I see that there's other folks who want to talk, probably have more interesting things to say than I.
I do have several questions, if I could. So the General Assembly passed the legislation last year requiring these Section 527 organizations to file these disclosures. If the rule as you've proposed it were adopted, so that the effect of that here's the way I understand it, the effect of that legislation would be limited to organizations that expressly advocate the election or defeat of candidates. That would pretty much mean that legislation only applies to basically groups that are already required to report as political committees.
There's one slight difference. The way I read the structure of the rules as we've proposed it is it requires reporting of contributions or expenditures that influence or attempt to influence an election. So that way, if, for example, an organization, the Colorado Federation of Republican Women, received contributions for the purpose of making an election or communication, or for the purpose of expressly advocating, or if they made expenditures that did that, then they would be required to report that portion of their contributions and expenditures. That's slightly different than them being a political committee, because the definition of a political committee obviously is someone who, for example, makes expenditures, but a political committee, in order to be regulated as a political committee, you also have to have a major purpose of being a political committee. Although that's not in the Constitution, the court in the Alliance, the Colorado Court of Appeals, Alliance for Colorado Families versus Gilbert, actually read that into the into the law when they remanded it. And likewise, there's the Colorado Right to Life case, in which the court struck down, at least on an as-applied basis, a regulation that did not have, for an organization that did not have a major purpose. So there's a slight difference. This would actually regulate that particular portion of the Colorado Federation of Republicans Women's activities that was an election or communication or was express advocacy without regulating the entire entity as a whole.
Okay.
So it doesn't entirely limit it just to organizations that are already regulated.
I mean, it would be a fair statement, wouldn't it, that at the very least, though, it would substantially limit the law as written by the General Assembly.
I think that's a fair statement.
And it would be based on the rationale that the legislation is unconstitutionally overbroad, basically. The Secretary of State would have to make a finding, basically, that that statute is unconstitutional in order to adopt the proposed rule.
I'm not familiar with the Secretary of State making sort of those types of formal findings, but for example, the recent change to election and communications based on the Wisconsin Right to Life case and the Harwood versus Senate Majority Fund Rule 9.4, this is exactly what it's exactly what the Secretary of State's office did. They basically said, excuse me, the definition of electioneering communications has to be changed, has to be limited based on these other cases that we have seen. And, for example, Wisconsin Right to Life never passed judgment upon a Colorado statute, obviously. The difference we have here is that we have the case law that was initially, you know, the case law existed, and then the statute comes into effect, as opposed to the statute coming into effect and later case law that may impact that. So it differs from 9.4 in just sort of the chronology, but I think as far as the principle goes, you're still, I mean, the Secretary of State does, I think, have to, it doesn't have to, but I think it's good policy to interpret laws in a manner that's constitutional in order to maintain the constitutionality of those laws, even if it's not exactly what was intended by the General Assembly. Another example is the definition of issue committee. It's section 2.10 in Article 28, and it's rule, I think it's 1.14. No. It is 1.7, rule 1.7. And that defines an issue committee is a group that meets both conditions, section 210.1a and 210A1 says collectors spend money to support or oppose a ballot issue. The second portion is you have a major purpose of doing that. Colorado Constitution says either one or two, and this office has interpreted it to be one and two. So it's a more restrictive interpretation of the Colorado Constitution there as well. So. I don't know if you have to make a formal finding as to unconstitutionality. I've not seen that happen in the past. But I would say that there's ample precedent for this office interpreting, using regulations to interpret laws in a constitutional manner.
Okay. Let me ask about, well, the legislation that was adopted, you know, as you're aware, because you testified.
I was the only one testifying in opposition to it, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
There was some refinement of the language as originally introduced, and I'm trying to remember accurately, and you can probably correct me, but what ultimately was adopted was really a two-prong test for an entity to come under the requirements of the legislation. They have to be not only engaged in influencing or attempting to influence, but they also would have to have sought tax-exempt status under Section 527 of the Internal Revenue Code. And at least the for those who were on the other side of the issue, trying to make it constitutional from the General Assembly's perspective, I think that second prong was really important, because the idea was that if you have sought a tax benefit, a nonprofit tax benefit, then that allows the General Assembly to be more regulatory. If you'd like to comment.
Certainly.
On that.
I understand that argument perfectly well, and I tried to anticipate that argument, and I believe it is a valiant attempt of the Secretary of State's office to work with the legislature, but it is nonetheless unavailing. And here are my points. One is, the language itself doesn't necessarily say you seek an exemption under 527. It says is exempt or seeks an exemption. And the reason that's important, because if you're under $25,000 under federal law, you don't have to seek an exemption. You're just automatically exempt, and you don't actually have to do anything. That sort of goes to the burdensomeness. The way Section 527 is organized is you have to file two reports under Section 527. A report of organization, that's an 8871, and then regular reports, which is an 8872. There's an 84X. I'm actually not making that up. That is the name of the form. But you don't, and so one you say, hey, I'm a 527, and the other you say, hey, these are my reports. But if you're under $25,000, you don't even have to say, hey, I'm a 527. So you don't even have to seek an exemption. You're just automatically exempt under it. So it's a little bit of a nuance.
Let me ask you about that, because that's actually where I was going with my question. If you're under 25, if you're an organization that's under $25,000, I was interpreting the state statute as saying you're not required to report at all. You're not exempt under Section 527 from taxation. You're not subject to taxation under Section 527 because you're under the $25,000. It's not an exemption. Are we saying the same thing?
I don't know. I mean, we could, I guess, sort of, it's like arguing how many angels are dancing on the head of a pin when you get into this level on the tax law.
Well, it's kind of important in that, if I'm understanding this correctly, if you're an organization that's below the $25,000 threshold, even if you do engage in influencing or attempting to influence, you would not be required to report under the state statute because you don't come under Section 527.
You see, the way I interpret it is you still come under Section 527. Section 527 specifically says, identifies you as an organization subject to regulation, but then exempts you from the regulation. I think the way 527 is created, it doesn't say 527 only applies to organizations of $25,000 or more. 527 says we apply to all organizations, but if you're under $25,000 or reasonably expect to be under $25,000, then you don't have to do this particular level of reporting.
Okay.
So even though it's meaningless, I guess, that you're under 527 because you still don't have to do anything, the IRS, as I interpret that section, this sort of, you see it repeatedly, the IRS says, you're subject to our regulation, but we're not going to regulate you. And I think that's what happens here.
Okay.
So I think you'd still fall underneath this as far as the influencing or attempting to influence, and you're exempt.
Okay.
Under 527. So that's the first thing. The second point is, and I understand exactly the rationale that, you know, you're getting a tax benefit, and because you're getting the tax benefit, we, the state, are allowed to regulate you. I mean, that's sort of the rationale. And that is drawn specifically, and I think I cited it in my letter, if I can find it, the Mobile, Alabama case. Find it at the moment. It's the Republican Assemblies versus the the National Federation of Republican Assemblies versus the U.S. And then that was vacated by the Mobile Republican Assembly. And that's why I touched on the history of this a little bit. These are the only two cases that have even looked at the constitutionality of Section 527. And the district court basically said, no way, this is unconstitutional. It's an unconstitutional infringement upon people's rights. The circuit court vacated that decision, and it adopted different reasoning. And what it said is, this is a tax break that you're getting. Okay, you're getting this tax break, and in response to this tax break, you have to do this filing. And because you're getting a benefit in response to a tax break, the Anti-Injunction Act applies. And because the Anti-Injunction Act applies, you, person suing the state, you cannot sue until after you pay the tax, because you have to pay a tax. If you don't do all this reporting, you have to pay a tax. That's the penalty. You have to wait until you pay the tax, and then you sue to get your tax refund and to say it's unconstitutional that you had to do this. That's what the circuit court said. So the circuit court did not rest its decision on saying this is constitutional because you're getting a tax break. It hinted at that. It hinted at that, but it didn't say it. What it did say is, you're getting a tax break, therefore the Anti-Injunction Act applies, and because the Anti-Injunction Act applies, this case is not ripe. You don't have standing. The case is not ripe to be able to bring before this court. So we dismissed it on jurisdictional grounds. So there's no court case, I think, that's ever embraced that. I mean, there's no court case that's rejected that theory that you just articulated. But I think that in this context, in Colorado, you got two things that distinguish it from the National Federation of Republican Assemblies. First of all, this isn't a tax regulation. Now, I understand an attempt to say it's a tax regulation, to claim that, you know, the Colorado Federation of Republican Women is getting a Colorado tax break. I think that that would be a difficult case to make because it's not part of the tax code. It's part of the election code, and it's supported by, you know, even the testimony before the committee, and that was, you know, this is to stop nasty negative advertising, not, hey, we're giving these people a tax subsidy. I mean, that was not the purpose of it. So where it's located, and the purpose behind this is not a tax purpose. So that's the first distinguishing Republican assemblies on factual grounds. And I think the second way to distinguish it is, if there were a lawsuit brought here, and this is, I mean, I guess this is a perfect law school exam. You know, we don't have the jurisdictional problems that we had, or that the plaintiffs had, in the National Federation of Republican Assemblies. So we don't have to worry about the Anti-Injunction Act. We don't have to worry about all these tax issues. We go straight to the heart of the matter. So it's essentially a way to allow a court to directly look at this. And then my third point would be, at that point, the court's going to be required to look at, squarely confront the language of influence or attempt to influence. And at that point, I think Buckley versus Vallejo is controlling.
Okay. Maybe one last question.
Sure.
Although the others, I think, can testify to this. Going back to the $25,000 threshold, are most of the Republican women's groups, would they be under that $25,000?
I think almost all of them would be, except for the state. The way it works... just for a little framework, the way, and I may be disabused if I say something wrong here, but you have the state Colorado Federation of Republican Women. That is likely subject to the, it's greater than 25,000.
Yeah.
And then you have a whole variety of smaller organizations. Some are sort of county-based and city-based, and there's just a whole bunch of them, you know, scores of them out throughout Colorado. They're affiliated with the state, because they have to conform their bylaws, and they have to share the same purposes, and they provide dues to the state. They transfer a portion of their members' dues to the state membership organization. But they are themselves freestanding organizations, and those freestanding organizations throughout the state, I think, almost uniformly are under $25,000.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Gessler?
Okay, and so the issue is giving to candidate committees. Am I correct? That brings them under the 527 rule?
It's a little bit broader than that. I think if they give to candidate committees now, they would be regulated in the sense that if they had a major purpose of doing that, they'd be a political committee and be entirely regulated. And that contribution itself to the candidate committee has to be reported. The issue right now, I think, is that whatever they do under the scope of this new law, or last year's law, middle-aged law now, regardless of what they do, it can be construed as influencing or attempting to influence an election. And therefore, whatever they do has to be reported. So they have to do all the same reporting requirements as, for example, a political committee would. But they're not a political committee. They're not directly contributing to candidates. But I think that's the concern. I think a lot of these organizations recognize that, you know, if they're regularly giving to candidate committees, there's going to be some type of regulation. I don't think that's a concern. They're prepared to deal with that. But what they're concerned about and not prepared to deal with, well, prepared may not be the right word, that's burdensome for them to deal with is having to report every speck and iota of all of their activities on a regular basis to the Secretary of State's office. So I think that's the issue that they're looking to face.
Okay. Marty, thank you.
All right, thank you.
Next person signed up to testify, Ryan Call.
Ms. Trumps, for the panel's benefit, I'd like to yield my time now to the ladies to speak if so that we're talking about respect to the Republican movement, and after that, perhaps I can.
Okay. Let's see, Kathy Percival. You'll identify yourself for the record and who you represent, please.
Thank you. I'm Kathy Percival from Delta County, and I'm reading into the record of the written testimony of Kelly A. Wiest, Esquire General Counsel to the Colorado Federation of Republican Women. In lieu of appearance for the July 1, 2008 SOS rulemaking hearing, Mr. Secretary, this written testimony is in support of the proposed amendment to promulgated rule 4.20.1, referring to CRS 1-45-103-14.5. The Colorado Federation of Republican Women has requested a rulemaking in order to further define Rule 4.20.1 by adding the following language. The term, end quote, influencing or attempting to influence, end quote, shall mean expressly advocating the election or defeat of a candidate or making an electioneering communication. Our outside counsel, Scott Gessler, will have testified to the legal reasoning behind our request for rulemaking, but I wish to present the factual situation for our request. The Colorado Federation of Republican Women is the largest women's grassroots organization in Colorado, encompassing 48 unit clubs and approximately 2,000 members. The Colorado Federation of Republican Women has been in existence since 1938, being the first state federation under the National Federation of Republican Women, founded the same year, and the largest women's grassroots group in the country. For the past 70 years, the CFRW and its unit clubs have educated Coloradians about Republican policies, values, and candidates, and have played large roles in their communities by doing community and charitable work. Today, the 2,000 women of the CFRW's unit clubs buy books for schools, volunteer in many historical institutions, donate money, food, and clothing to the troops and their families, raise money to restore communities, mentor young women and disadvantaged mothers, volunteer in hospitals, and yes, exemplify the values and principles of the Republican Party and Republican philosophy. When the legislation known as HB 1074 became law as CRS 1-45-103-14.5 in July 2007, the CFRW and its unit clubs were thrown into extensive confusion. While we had been aware of Colorado campaign finance restrictions and disclosure laws, CFRW clubs had not been encompassed thereby. In 2005, the NFRW had advised state federations that the NFRW had filed as a 527 organization with the IRS and was making annual returns as required, and that the state federations were advised to do so as well. The CFRW did file as a 527 that year and filed annual returns, but advised its unit clubs pursuant to IRS regulations that unless a unit club expected to receive at least $25,000 in revenue in a calendar year, those clubs did not have to file as a 527 or file returns. When HB 1074 became law, I advised the CFRW and its unit clubs that disclosure reports under Colorado law were now required. This requirement had caused great confusion and consternation among the unit clubs and their members. After 9 months of compliance, I can testify to three things. One, our unit clubs and their officers are totally confused as to the law. Although the elections division of the SOS has spent a great deal of time helping me and our unit clubs, there is still a great deal of confusion over what should be reported and in what manner. In addition, the unit clubs generally elect new officers at least every 2 years, which means that a club treasurer has a steep learning curve to compliance with the law. Two, the reporting requirements are quite burdensome to these clubs' operations. The unit clubs range from 10 to 200 members and are true grassroots operations. Their officers are all volunteers from the membership, receive no compensation, and are not required to have any particular skills. Therefore, clubs have operated as community organizations have throughout history, with their membership dues being recorded in a check register, their directories typed on typewriters and PCs for distribution to members, and their expenditures directed toward membership and community activities. When the disclosure requirements went into effect, I spent well over 500 hours as general counsel trying to assist clubs in filling out forms. In many cases, the club treasurer only kept records in a check register without all the information required by the disclosures and did not possess a computer or internet connectivity to which to file the forms. Three, the sweeping reporting requirements, in particular, the requirement of reporting membership dues, have caused a great deal of anger. In fact, I've been tracking the effect on membership in the unit clubs and can testify that the CFRW has lost 3 clubs due to the reporting requirements, and that every unit club has lost both members and donations due to law. In addition, clubs have had difficulties in recruiting treasurers due to the burdensome and confusing nature of the reporting requirements. As Republicans, we believe strongly in the freedom of speech, especially political speech, and the freedom of association. We believe that the overreaching aspects of compliance with CRS 1-45-103 14.5 violate these principles by not distinguishing between those contributions and expenditures that are expressly political advocacy and those that stem from membership, charitable activities, or the like. The law violates the strictures of Buckley versus Valero. In particular, by requiring the disclosure of membership dues, the law violates the guarantee of freedom of association. The effect of the freezing of CFRW's rights to free speech and to free association are clearly in evidence. The loss of members and whole clubs, the difficulty in recruiting officers, the decrease in donations. Buckley versus Vallejo and its progeny clearly require that these violations be mitigated by the proposed amendment to Rule 4.20.1 as requested. Mr. Secretary, I regret that I am unable to appear before you today due to a long-planned family vacation in Williamsburg, Virginia. As I walk the streets of the revolutionary city and explain to my children why the founders and the Continental Army rebelled against the British, I'm struck by the fact that the most egregious sin against liberty is that of repressing free political speech in the name of order. It is ridiculous to require a pure grassroots organization that does much for the community and the state to report every contribution by an elderly lady to pay for phone cards for the troops, or every contribution by the club to buy books for schools. It serves no purpose of liberty, but only a purpose of repression. Thank you, and I'm reading it for Kelly A. Wiest, Esquire, General Counsel to the Colorado Federation of Republican Women.
Do you have a copy that we can have for the record?
Yes, we do.
Okay. Any questions for Ms. Percival? Thank you very much. The next person on the sign-up list, Jackie Stafford.
Jackie.
Okay. Sharon Sollenberger? Sorry.
Mr. Secretary, Mr. Hobbs, I am Sharon Sollenberger from Grand Junction, Colorado. I'm the immediate past president of the Colorado Federation of Republican Women and the current third vice president of the National Federation. To say that the reporting requirements on this law are burdensome is sort of an understatement. However, I will let the other ladies that are the treasurers tell you how many hours they put on this. We already know that Kelly has put in, as she said, at least 500 hours or more helping these treasurers with these reports. I think our biggest concern, or one of our biggest concerns, was the act of having to post names, addresses, and other private information on the internet, which of course came in under this reporting thing, because that made our membership lists public. And our membership lists of the Federation, both national and state, are proprietary. We don't give them to anyone. We don't give them to candidates. We don't give them to our central committee. So it is certainly a proprietary situation. Many of our members just absolutely did not want their names out there for whatever reason. They have this big thing about internet privacy, and I can understand that. We have lost clubs and members because of that requirement. It's very difficult to get treasurers and officers for the clubs because of personal liability issues because of this law, and also because of the reporting issues, because it takes up pretty much all of their life on these reporting issues, especially during an election cycle. I don't think that any one of the 48 clubs, existing clubs at this point, have anything near $25,000. They are lucky if they have $1,000. Mostly, if they have fundraising, the fundraising is directed for a Support the Troops program, library books, dictionaries for children, the community activities. When we do have political fundraisers, they are reported, as they should be. I think the term of influencing an election is really interesting because I have yet to know a candidate or an issue where $20 is going to make an influence. So I think probably the biggest, our biggest concerns are the fact that we have burdened our treasurers, and God bless them, a lot of little old gray-haired ladies that haven't seen a PC in years and wouldn't know one if they saw it, or even our younger ones that are politically savvy and also computer literate, have a terrible time getting this all entered. I think probably the biggest question that we have is the fact that our proprietary membership list is now public. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Janine Schuster?
I'm Janine Schuster. I'm a member of Colorado Federation of Republican Women, Mesa County Republican Women Treasurer. So I'm talking from that perspective. When I've heard the words confusion, angry, burdened, yes, that's me. I now find myself scheduling my life around my reporting for this bill. In an election year, we start out reporting every month, then it becomes twice a month, and it becomes more frequent from then on. I try to be very conscientious, but yes, I'm confused. I want to do the very best job that I can, so I am reporting every penny our club brings in and every penny our club spends. It just depends upon if it's an itemized transaction with the person's personal information, with their name and address, or if it's an accumulative amount. And yes, we are starting to lose some volunteers. We're starting to lose revenue. I'm a retired teacher, and I've learned how people start playing games about testing. Well, now some of our activities, we're saying, you know, it's $19.99, so we're not having to report the personal information on those people. Because I agree, I think it is an invasion of privacy for these people when we're reporting their personal information for public viewing. The way I understand it is if it's an income or expense of $100 or more, we also have to report about their employer and their occupation. And I'm very embarrassed to ask people that information to tell them what I'm going to do with it. Our little club, we have a membership of 120, and our net income for 2007 was about $2,500. That was our net income. So that kind of shows you where you are. And as Sharon and the others have spoken, our projects, we support projects with hospice, buying books for the library. We do those types of things. Our mission for Mesa County Republican Women is to educate and inform the public about our Republican ideals and how to become a better citizen. And I feel very burdened with have this reporting. I just feel like my time as a Republican woman could be spent better promoting Americanism, patriotism, helping people become better citizens rather than sitting at my computer and plugging numbers and people's information. So I appreciate you hearing this, and we'd appreciate helping us out with this.
If I may ask a question that actually occurs to me from several of the comments that folks have offered today, you know, one of the fundamental bases of the campaign finance laws is disclosure of
yes.
of contributions, and individuals, not under this law but under other laws, you know, that provide make donations to candidates, if they contribute more than $20, then to a candidate. Or to a political committee, then those individuals' names and addresses appear on public records on the internet, even without this law. Mm-hmm. And in fact, if they contribute to candidates more than $100, even their occupation and employer is disclosed publicly. And I guess my question is, although there's certainly concerns that plenty of people have expressed about that, separate from this issue, would it be fair to infer that a lot of the club members are not already having their name and address disclosed publicly because they're making contributions to candidates, but rather they're getting under this law, the 527 law, for the first time? They're finding themselves, perhaps their privacy being violated and so forth?
That's kind of my feeling, is that they may not be people that are donating to the candidates in that regard, because they have seemed rather surprised with our membership when they pay their dues of $25 that we do have to report that on the internet. So I'm not sure that those folks, I don't know if, what the percentage of those folks are that mm-hmm. are donating to candidates and, you know, falling under that.
Or they may also not be aware.
That's true.
Until this came to light that
true.
Really is public information. So.
You, your club gives directly to candidates. Your club give directly to candidates.
No.
Committees.
No. Yeah. No. And no. I got the answer right, guys. No, I know. But no. And we, as a club, we don't give money to any candidate either.
Well, do you give money to any political committees?
No.
To include the Mesa County Republican Party.
No, we just pay our part of our dues to the Colorado Federation of Republican Women. But no, we don't give money to any candidates or any of their committees. You know, we're Republicans. At some of our functions, we allow some of those people to come and speak, but you know, we don't.
Brian or Mr. Gessler, is that true of all? Is that that's true across the board?
Generally, I think it's general. Some clubs do set up a political committee.
Right. Ryan, you probably ought to get up to the mic so we can get you recorded.
I am aware that some, I'm not sure if any of the chapters of the Republican Women's, but other similar party ally organizations, if they choose to make direct contributions to candidates, to political party committees at the county or state level, will generally do that through a sponsored political committee. Is subject to the registration reporting, but as to their club itself, they or organizations, they don't generally give them out of the general treasury fund, if you will, of the membership group or the chapter.
no transfer then from their general operating account to that political committee. It's members donating directly to...
To the political committee in terms of the reporting. So they're subject to the registration reporting and the disclosure on that. And I think that that underlines and really sort of clarifies some of the discussion that Mr. Gessler had underlined in the context. This really ropes in a huge new category of membership-based organizations and underscores the ambiguity with what does it mean to influence an election? Does it mean taking a candidate to lunch or sponsoring a forum or any number of things that could be construed as that, triggering that? And I'll save my comments in terms of some additional discussion about Section 527 concerns and others. But just an answer to that one question as to, do they use general treasury funds from the club to make contributions to candidates and political parties? My understanding is they do not. Some groups do sponsor separate political committees or small donor committees, but those are subject to the regime, and they know that's what they're signing up for. I think most people, in terms of a $25 membership fee, didn't know they were signing up for essentially the same level of disclosure as a political committee that is subject to that regulation, and that is directly influencing elections because you're giving money to candidates. That's not what's happening here. The vast majority of the expenditures and contributions going to the club don't do that kind of direct, and thus, you know, you're looking at that analysis of, is it really permissible purpose for the state to regulate.
Thank you, Mr. Paul.
Okay. The next person I have signed up to testify is Lynn Sanchez. Welcome.
Good afternoon. I'm here on behalf of the Federation. My name is Linda J. Sanchez. I go by Lynn. I'm from La Plata County. I am a member of the Southwest Republican Women. I'm also the national chair for the Armed Services Committee. I am a veteran. My concern is that a number of our members throughout the state are concerned about their privacy. The National Federation, the state, and the local clubs all follow under their bylaws that we are not allowed to give any funds directly to a candidate. Correct? Okay. Right. We will buy their lunch. And I can tell you that we are a big influence in our community. One thing that we make sure is that the libraries are provided with quality books for not only children in colleges, but we also help with the literacy programs for adults who haven't had the opportunity to learn to read. And we also make sure that fifth graders in this state have dictionaries if there's not other volunteer organizations that has that program. We are extremely active in supporting the troops. As of this year, taking over the chair, we are involved in providing to the Fisher House. The way we do that, so that you know, is individuals write checks, not to the clubs. It does not come out of the club accounts. It comes from individuals. We do support it. We encourage it so that we can build Fisher House houses. But for those of you who don't know what a Fisher House is, it's this equivalent of what McDonald's houses are for private citizens. These are for military families. We do highway cleanups. We go into the schools and we volunteer for the reading programs because the Republicans women feel that reading is the most important thing a child can do. If they're educated, they're not illiterate. And they're better to be educated and to be a more viable American to their country. I know that as a veteran and working with military, and Secretary of State Kaufman can tell you, when you're in the military, you have the strictest privacy laws that cover you. If you don't volunteer your name, your address, and who you are, what your rank is, believe me, you can't go on the internet and find it. I feel like being an American veteran, I want to keep our rights intact and our privacy for us so that we don't lose members as we have, and that laws aren't made, so it's difficult even for our elderly people who are not computer literate, that it kind of shuts them out and makes it so that they're no longer able to be really involved. I could go on about all we do in the state and in the nation, but I hope that you will listen to our plea to you today and that you will define influence. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I'm not sure about other people that have signed in, whether they want to testify. Are there others that would like to testify? Some signed in and just didn't indicate whether they were going to testify or not, but you're certainly welcome to come forward if you've signed up.
I'm Ruth Schroyer, and I'm the treasurer of the Denver Women's Republican Club, and I've been treasurer for maybe 8 years. This is my last year. We have approximately 40 members, and we have a $1,000 operating budget. We receive money from dues, and we pass the hat at each meeting for pennies for politics and maybe collect $10 each meeting that way. We have definitely changed the way we do business and will continue to change due to the 1999 ruling, and I've been talking with other treasurers, and they've done some creative thinking and planning so that it will lessen the burden of their reporting. The issue that Mr. Gessler pointed out at the very end is the one that we seem to be wrestling with, is how do you interpret this influence? What is influencing the election? Our group promotes good citizenship and Republican ideals, and we have no small donor committee, and if someone wants to give me a donation for a candidate, I say, nope. It goes right to the candidate, and so we've totally divorced ourselves of anything like donations that way. That's it. Please interpret the rules. So it wouldn't be so burdensome if we knew what we were doing. Everybody, well, I've talked to Mr. Paul, I've got his interpretation, I've talked to Ms. Weiss, and I've gotten her interpretation, I've talked to some people from the Secretary of State's office, maybe it's a third interpretation. Just decide on one thing. What's, there's no more room for that. Please.
Thank you.
I'll probably be your last speaker for the day. I'm Ruth Dolan, and I'm current president for the Denver Republican Women's Club. And Ruth has just told you how much money we take in, and we're just operating on a shoestring. We do send things to the troops in Afghanistan and Iraq, and we have donated to the Denver Rescue Mission and the Gathering Place, so that if we have any money left over at the end of the year, which is unlikely, it will maybe go for something like that, but it actually doesn't come out of the treasury. It comes out of our pockets. We can't even use our Republican Club money to support a campaign such as Mike Kaufman's. We would like to. No, we really would. We would like to. But we are prohibited from doing that. So if we want money to go to Mike or anybody else, we have to do it out of our own pocket, not out of our treasury. I can be a real grassroots citizen because I started to vote in 1950, I think. As soon as I turned 21 in 1951, I voted for Eisenhower, and I've been a solid Republican ever since. So, and I've done everything that the Republican grassroots people do, work for the judges, do a block worker. I've been a committee woman since 1972. I just got out this year, so I'm 78 years old. I'm going to retire from that role, and I doubt that you're going to find too many chickens who will want to come in and be president and treasurer. Ruth is, you know, she takes care of every jot and tittle. And so you can track her money. Now, here's what I'd like to know, is what in the world does the Secretary of the State or whoever else collects this paper do with it? I mean, we could have a mountain built to the House Bill 1027. I think that's where our trouble started, when the legislature decided they could fix something that wasn't broken. So I'm asking you to fix it. Now, what do we have to do? Amend it properly so it doesn't become so burdensome. Because it really is cruel and unusual punishment. If we were going to be electrocuted, we could probably charge the state against this. I think I better quit while I'm ahead. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else before I turn to Mr. Call? Okay, Mr. Call.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Mr. Hobbs, again, for the record, my name is Ryan Call, and I'm an attorney with the law firm of Zach and Atherton. Our firm represents quite a number of different political organizations, committees, outside groups as well. And so I'm going to be coming at the testifying with respect to the rule as proposed from a couple different perspectives. I've very much enjoyed the wonderful testimony of these good ladies who are engaged in their community and trying to be an influence for good as they see it. And I personally would think that being an influence for Republican politics is an influence for good, but I'm not sure if that's part of the record. But again, the core of what we're looking at today in connection with this rule is defining what it means to influence or attempt to influence, as that being the sort of triggering event that requires reporting and disclosure to the Secretary of State. Mr. Gessler did a wonderful job of describing the case law and all that. I wanted to call your attention, however, Mr. Secretary, to a couple of other provisions in case law that I think are both applicable and instructive. We're describing the importance of the Secretary of State to adopt a narrowing construction of the rules adopted by the legislature to be able to both to pass constitutional muster as well as to be able to provide a workable system for folks to work within. In the 2001 case of League of Women Voters versus Davidson, which you're probably very familiar with, the court spent quite a lot of time describing this problem of vagueness and overbreadth, which is exactly what we're dealing with here in the context of how do you define and apply what it means to influence or attempt to influence the outcome of elections. The court reiterated both in the Davidson case as well as citing from Supreme Court cases such as Buckley versus American Constitutional Law Foundation, the 1999 case, saying that the court reiterated, and this is again the Supreme Court, quoted by the Court of Appeals, reiterated that exacting scrutiny is necessary when compelled disclosure of campaign-related payments is at issue. And that's really what we're looking at in this context. And so the court in League of Women Voters v. Davidson, which are my position, and we've been trying to counsel most of our clients, is that that's still good law in Colorado, even though it does predate the McConnell decision, is that a broad kind of context-based approach is just too ambiguous. And so the court in League of Women Voters versus Davidson said this, again quoting from the court, a third analysis and one in which we agree, this is the court in Davidson, permits the regulation only of those expenditures that are used for communications that, quote, expressly advocate the election or defeat of a clearly identified candidate. In other words, the standard includes the words and phrases listed in the Buckley case that Mr. Gessler so adequately and insightfully analyzed. And that's really what needs to happen here, in my view, to be able to have both a regime that passes constitutional muster as well as provides the kind of clarity that is needed for grassroots organizations such as the League of and the Republican Women organizations, as well as many, many other membership-based, as well as other groups that have as part of their mission, you know, influencing elections, but aren't really sure what that means or what triggers those reporting requirements. Our firm represents numerous other party-allied organizations such as the Federation of College Republicans, the Young Republican organizations, other business trade associations, which have set up separate 527 organizations so that they can isolate their expenditures with respect to Colorado elections and then meet the reporting requirements. And as a practitioner, as an attorney, I am constantly struggling with how to provide counsel to my clients, whether they be small membership-based organizations like Republican Women or College Republican chapters at the University of Colorado at Boulder, which have very small budgets but a lot of activism, how they are to now comply with this new law. And because the definition of what does it mean to influence or attempt to influence the outcome of elections is so vague and so broad, it basically means that, you know, the council is erring on the side of disclosing everything. That imposes not only a huge administrative burden, but in many very real ways, I think, tramples on the First Amendment as well as the rights for both speech and association that are an important factor of this. If they were engaging in activities that were giving contributions directly to parties or candidates, engaging in express advocacy that would cause them to be deemed to be either political committees or subject to other regulation, they're all right with that. It's this vague and unconstitutionally overbroad decision of what it means to be influencing or attempting to influence elections that's very difficult as an attorney to provide counsel to clients, whether that, again, is small membership-based organizations like this or even for larger trade association 527s or different groups that are formed specifically to influence state or local elections. I wanted to comment briefly, in addition to calling your attention to the League of Women Voter cases as well as the cases that Court of Appeals cited, a bit of a discussion as to some of the questions that Mr. Hobbs raised about, you know, the way that the current legislative regime requires the triggering of registration and reporting under Section 527. It's been my counsel and my analysis that even if you don't have to register and report under Section 527, the language of the statute as is imposed, if you are tax exempt under that provision, even if you don't have to register, report, disclose, file the 8871 or 8872 reports, if you, as an entity, are tax exempt under Section 527 versus being tax exempt under Section 501c4 or c6 or c5 or some other tax code section, if you are a nonprofit organization, you've got to decide, what are you tax exempt under? Are you under, which box are you in when you set up your EIN number and all that other thing? And even though you may not reach that $25,000 threshold, you are still tax exempt as an entity pursuant to Section 527. And so under our rules that are in place in the Secretary or under Colorado, you would have to report after $20 of contributions coming in versus that $25,000 threshold. If the rule has been proposed by Mr. Gessler is adopted today, I think it meets both the constitutional thresholds that are going to be necessary for helping provide, you know, passing that threshold test, but it also helps provide some guidance in terms of triggering event and administrative burden. If an organization, whether that be a membership organization or a trade association that sponsors a separate 527 entity or just a group of individuals or donors that want to influence elections, decides to get together and form a separate organization to influence elections, they will know when you cross that threshold, when you have to register and report, and what you have to register and report, if the term influencing or attempting to influence is narrowly defined and applied in the rule. So that's kind of our comment on that. I'm happy to take and answer any questions that you have.
You would certainly say, Mr. Call, that if in fact a chapter of this Federation of Republican Women, if they purchased an ad, so they didn't give directly to a political committee, but they purchased an ad that was for or against a candidate or a slate of candidates on a partisan basis, then you would certainly regard that as electioneering.
Without question. I mean, we look at both the very helpful guidance the Secretary of State has adopted presently in response to the Wisconsin Right to Life case in determining what constitutes an electioneering communication. That's very helpful in defining, okay, this is what it means and this is what it doesn't mean. You also looked at the case law and being able to provide guidance to your client to say, yes, you now fall in the box of your 527 and subject to reporting. Or if you're engaging in other types of communications that may cause your organization to be deemed to be a political committee. Those are much more clear lines that as an attorney you can counsel your client, okay, if you do these sorts of things, you're on this side of the line. If you do these other sorts of things and you've crossed the line, now you're subject to registration and reporting as a political committee. Or if this rule is adopted, then we will know where that boundary is to say, now you have to disclose in terms of your contributions and expenditures that are designed to influence elections, because we've got a very clear, bright-line test of, okay, here it is or here it's not. And I see it as really sort of there's different degrees. In answer to your question previously, Mr. Hobbs, I think that there is that window of you are not, there are some things you can do that make you subject to, if this rule were to be adopted, that would make you subject to registration, disclosure, and reporting as a 527 organization, but not subject to the reporting or contribution limits as a political committee. There does seem to be that sort of middle status, if you will, if this rule were to be adopted. Right now, it's very unclear, particularly since many nonprofit or small organizations never really figure out, are they a 501c4 or are they 527, what's their tax status, because they never really have to for the federal tax code provisions because of that $25,000 threshold. But you would help provide important clarity by adopting the rule that's been proposed.
Sure.
Any other questions?
Yeah, I do have some questions, because the more I hear, the more I'm confused about the federal tax laws and how they relate to Colorado laws.
You've underscored exactly the concern and the problem, Mr. Hobbs.
So are the Republican women's clubs, are they typically tax exempt under 501c4?
It depends, and I can speak from some experience both in help in providing some advice to some of the chapters that have asked me, but also from numerous other similar party allied organizations. They never had to ask that question because they were never beyond the reporting thresholds. Generally speaking, they have to make a decision. Is their principal purpose designed to influence elections, or do they have a principal purpose of a civic league or a social welfare organization that may have a minor purpose influencing elections but not its major purpose? Then they would be tax exempt under Section 501c4, and that is some. Think of an unclear line of, well, how much is a major purpose and how much is not? That's always difficult. But most of the allied party organizations, whether you look at the Republican women organizations, the college Republicans, they went from, at the national level, from being a 501c4 to electing to be a Section 527 organization, whereas the mass majority of the chapters at the state and local level for the college Republicans have decided to elect a tax status under Section 501c4 because they do more leadership training, campus activism, things like that, that would be more appropriately described under Section C4, and also to try to, quite frankly, avoid being deemed to be a 527 for the registration and reporting regime. So what, in effect, is happening is this regime that's being put in place is causing people to essentially have to err on the side of caution and reporting everything, or flee into a C4 status, which provides no disclosure or registration or reporting. Does that make sense? Please.
Mr. Hobbs, also, with respect to the C4, I think, with respect to Colorado Federation of Republican Women, the answer is no, they're not C4s. I mean, I have struggled in other contexts with the IRS to get an organization with the name Republican in its title, with the word Republican in its name, to be considered a C4, and the IRS, sort of rejected it based on that element alone. But we spent a lot of time sort of looking at the CFRW bylaws and articles of incorporation, what their functions are, what they do on a day-to-day basis, and it seems as though it's appropriate for them to be a 527 rather than a C4. There's a slight difference in how the organizations are created. 527, you self-designate. C4, you can behave as a C4, but ultimately you either should, or the IRS would like you to, get an official stamp of approval from the IRS where they actually review an application. IRS doesn't review a 527 application for adequacy. You simply notify it that you're 527. To become a C4, and act as a C4, you have to fill in a form and actually get the approval, the stamp of approval from the IRS as a C4. So it's a slightly different process. When you're a small organization, you can generally ignore that because 527s, you got a $25,000 limit. C4s for the tax returns is a $15,000 limit. So if you're under both those thresholds, you don't really have to worry about it. But at least based on our analysis, at least the CFRW and their constituent or their affiliated organizations, they're not C4s. It'd be nice for them to be C4s, but they're probably not.
And I'm sorry for still being confused. When they're incorporated,
correct.
And when they're are
some
they
some of them are. I'm not sure all of them are.
Okay. Are they? And so they're incorporated as nonprofits. They would incorporate through a business filing with the Secretary of State as a nonprofit. And for purposes of incorporating, there's no need, I don't think, to designate what section of the Internal Revenue Code they're incorporating
Correct.
Under. They simply incorporate as a nonprofit corporation, and that's sufficient for purposes of forming a legal entity, I believe.
Correct.
Now, having done that, I think what I hear you saying is that may be sufficient, that if they're at least a unit club that's under 15,000, whether they consider, if they consider themselves a C4, would not have to register with the Internal Revenue Service. They wouldn't have to do anything at all unless
Right.
unless they choose to. And it sounds like under Section 527, many organizations may choose to register as 527 organizations, either, well, this is where I'm struggling, either because, well, both because they're over the $25,000 threshold and because they are engaged in influencing or attempting to influence or fear that they might be characterized as doing that.
Wait, your corporate status, whether you're a corporation or an LLC, is marginally related to your tax status. You can be an LLC in a 527. You can
mm-hmm.
be a corporation in a 527. You can be an unincorporated nonprofit association in a 527. You can be all of that stuff, and you can be a C4 as well. Okay, so that's sort of only marginally related. If you're a small organization, from a practical standpoint, it doesn't matter. If you're under $15,000 and you're a C4, or you act like a C4, you don't have to do anything. You don't have to file any tax returns. You don't have to do anything. Okay? If you're under $25,000, and if you act like a 527 and you are a 527, you don't have to do anything as well, just because you're so small. The IRS says we're not going to bother with that. It's only when you reach certain thresholds that you have to begin to worry about this stuff on the federal side. Once you hit $15,000 and you're acting like a C4 or a C6 or anything but a C3, really, you're acting like that, you have to file your tax return, your 990 tax returns, okay? In which you say, hey, I'm acting like a C4 or a C6, and here's my tax returns, okay? If you're acting like a 527, you have to file that. If you're acting like a 527, once you hit $25,000, then you have to, you know, pop your head up and be recognized by the IRS at that point, okay? Does that answer your question?
Well, partially. I guess part of what I'm wondering is, okay, if the Secretary of State were to adopt the rule that's proposed today, and that calls for a narrowed interpretation of the state statute that says you're required to report at the
right.
state level if you're influencing or attempting influence, organizations still have a Section 527 issue, which has the same language that says you have to register as a 527
yes.
if you're influencing or attempting to influence. And
yes.
nothing that the Secretary of State does will affect that difficulty, organizations not knowing whether they're influencing or attempting to influence. That's an Internal Revenue Code problem that won't be changed by whatever rule the
that
Secretary
is
of
correct.
State.
That is correct. It's a self-designation that with the IRS, the Section 527. And let me just finish one point. And this sort of, you know, welcome to the pain of the intersection of tax law and campaign finance law. Because the term influence and attempting to influence currently is valid under Section 527. The term, the exact same term, created out of the 1974 enactments by Congress that uses influence and attempting to influence under the election law is unconstitutional unless it's narrowed. You have the exact same language on the tax side and on the campaign finance side that are treated in two different ways. The narrowing construction that we're asking you to follow is embracing the election law stuff, the election law approach to these regulations. And perhaps one day we'll all sort out the tax code stuff. Maybe not. Well, we're asking to look at it from an election law framework. And I'm saying that, you know, the tax code framework remains ambiguous. A lot of the burdensome and onerous regulations from the tax code side are mitigated because of the higher thresholds they have. whereas this statute has no thresholds, well, the $20 threshold.
I think that's one of the fundamental points, is that unless your organization is going to raise or spend more than $25,000 in a calendar year, it doesn't have to spend money on hiring lawyers to help identify, are you a 527 or not? You know, the other kind of complicating factor in here is that under the code, if you are a 527 organization but also a qualified state or local political organization, then the threshold to report to the IRS is $100,000. So if people elect to be a 527 and report all their contributions and expenditures to the Secretary of State, then the threshold becomes $100,000. I know, but if you get other issues in terms of the way the Secretary decides to interpret and apply this rule, could have major impacts on how organizations, are they deemed to be a qualified state or local political organization for purposes of IRS reporting and disclosure, because then you're talking about a higher threshold reporting. You know, we would, again, I would kind of urge, again, looking at it in that elections context and adopting a narrow definition in terms of what it means to influence or attempt to influence elections to help us navigate this potentially, you know, difficult situation.
And if I could ask just one or two, I'm not trying to belabor this, but one or two other questions. I think kind of what I'm hearing here is that, well, let me take this away from the context of the Republican Women's Clubs. You know, it's my understanding that Section 527 organizations, I hope this, correct me if I'm wrong, a lot of 527 organizations sprung up in response to campaign finance laws as a relatively recent phenomenon, long past the formation of Republican Women's Clubs, because political groups figured out that if they did not expressly advocate the election or defeat of candidates, they could nevertheless influence the election or defeat of candidates without having to report, and that the intent of federal reporting, or certainly the intent of the General Assembly in requiring 527 organizations to report, was to reach those groups whose purpose was to influence elections without falling under the definitions of a political committee. I don't think they had in mind, I'm just suggesting, they did not have in mind civic organizations that were already in existence conducting themselves, you know, along the activities of we've heard today, but rather these true new 527 organizations. And the consequence of adopting the rule that you're suggesting would be those organizations would not report under Colorado law either. Is that correct?
That's right. And maybe this is helpful and illustrative for the Secretary in terms of the scope of his authority. It's precisely the reason that the reporting regime for 527 organizations that do not find themselves meeting the definition, particularly at the federal level, of a political committee or a candidate committee or a federal political party organization, which normally have to fall subject to the jurisdiction of the FEC and reporting to them, it's precisely for that reason that they report and disclose to the IRS, because the FEC has no jurisdiction over them because they haven't met the definitional tests necessary to make them into a political committee or make them into a federal candidate committee or others. And so the FEC has no jurisdiction because the FEC's jurisdiction is squarely within the elections context. Similarly here, we're talking about Secretary of State rulemaking authority with respect to clearly within the elections context. As such, it's our position, and Mr. Gessler would agree, that the Secretary needs to adopt a narrowing definition to be able to allow it to have authority with respect to regulating the elections context when it comes to finance. The federal election code, the federal tax status disclosure issues are a separate matter, and each organization is going to have to decide whether they've got to report to the IRS for those disclosure regimes. But as it relates to the authority of the Secretary under the elections code and under the Fair Campaign Practices Act, where this disclosure is found, you have to, in my view, adopt that narrowing constriction. Otherwise, you're running into those constitutional problems.
If I may take a shot at the General Assembly's intent, and I'm willing to speak bluntly here because I guess I earned it having to sit through the committee hearings. The General Assembly, I mean, and really, you look at the committee hearings, and the testimony was almost entirely about, and the discussions were almost entirely about, stopping negative campaign ads. That's really what everyone was unhappy about. Now, philosophically, one can argue that what this is a whole bunch of incumbents trying to protect themselves from criticism. I'm not going to try and engage that argument directly, but what I will say is that seemed to be the motivating factor in the way that the General Assembly thought, as I observed, thought of, quote, influencing an election was influencing an election through negative attack ads. So what are negative attack ads? Well, obviously, they unambiguously reference a candidate, but they also occur in proximity to an election. Okay, 527s operate year-round. And so I think the General Assembly was getting at that. Now, it should be pointed out that regardless of the General Assembly's intent, even their efforts to regulate the heck out of people as much as they want still run into the First Amendment. You know, so even if the General Assembly simply sought to reenact Colorado's electioneering communications regulations, that would be struck down, and that would be required to be, the Secretary of State of the entire state of Colorado, would be required to follow a narrowing construction as mandated by Harwood versus Senate Majority Fund on state level and Wisconsin Right to Life on the federal level. Because to influence an election in a manner that can be regulated by the state, okay, that's subject to regulation by the state, and that regulation is, you know, the reporting and the source restrictions and all of that stuff. Under the election law context, in order for that to be valid, it has to meet certain rules, okay? And to date, the rules have been express advocacy or the functional equivalent of express advocacy, okay? So, for example, influencing the election may very well be a get-out-the-vote drive where someone identifies people of one partisan persuasion and just gets them to the polls. I think under any definition, that's influencing an election. I think under any analysis under the U.S. Supreme Court, that is not an activity that may be regulated under campaign finance laws. So I think there's two ways to look at it. One is the intent of the General Assembly, which I think is far narrower than the language that they adopted, which is this broad thing of influence, which Lord knows what. But secondly, regardless of the General Assembly's intent, I still think there's a constitutional mandate upon the Secretary of State's office to interpret laws in a constitutional manner. And so you have to look at Buckley versus Valeo. You have to look at Wisconsin Right to Life, which this office has done. It's looked at Wisconsin Right to Life and restricted the definition of electioneering communications. Okay? It's looked at case law before and restricted the definition of an issue committee. I think it has to do the same thing here. And I understand concerns about the Assembly's intent. I don't think they're necessarily contradictory here.
And one thing you said that I don't follow, I mean, I don't see that a get-out-the-vote drive would be covered under Colorado's law. I mean, it's not influencing or attempting to influence the candidacy of an individual.
Let me launch into a little tax. The IRS has very specific regulations on get-out-the-vote drives. And get-out-the-vote drives are only allowable under a 501c3 or C4 entity, a C entity, only if it's a nonpartisan get-out-the-vote drive. And so, and the way they define nonpartisan is you're not allowed to identify people by geographical profile or propensity to vote. There's a whole string of regulations, actually. I don't have those memorized. I'll work on that. But don't have those memorized yet. And if you don't meet those very narrow definitions of what's allowed by a C entity, C4, C3, by default you fall into Section 527. Okay? So under Section 527, under the IRS interpretation, they sort of treat 527 as the garbage can. If you don't meet these narrow restrictions, you fall into 527 and you're, quote, influencing an election. So if you follow that interpretation, yeah, I think you are regulated under Colorado law as the statute currently reads.
I would echo that. I mean, there are plenty of organizations, whether it's the League of Women Voters or whether it's just a civic organization who might be maybe not even a partisan, but maybe an ideological type of organization who's interested in issues and wants to turn out the vote for poor people. Well, you're influencing the election because you're turning out those votes. So you would be subject to regulation under the current regime absent a narrowing definition or restriction on what it means to influence.
So any organization that conducts a voter registration drive is required to register under Section 527 if they meet the $25,000 threshold?
Not quite that far. If they don't meet the narrow requirements for a get out the vote drive or a voter registration drive under C4, under the C entities, C4, C3. You can be a C4 or C3 and do a get out the vote drive or a voter registration drive as a C4 or C3 under narrow circumstances.
Okay.
And if you go beyond those narrow circumstances, then you're stuck in the 527 bucket. So if the Colorado Federation of Republican Women decided that they wanted to, you know, buy donuts and juice for Saturday morning, get out the Republican vote drive, and they all knocked on Republican doors and reminded them to vote, okay, that would be influencing an election under the IRS regulations, certainly. But I think under a fair reading of the term influence, because it's so broad, would conceivably be would be encompassed under Colorado law as well. And then if you look at this General Assembly's intent in passing this, and you look at the comments before the committee, I don't think the committee ever intended to regulate that. And then I will also say, and I know this has absolutely no legal significance, but I do know legislators who have been talking to a lot of members of the CFRW saying this ruling doesn't apply to you. This doesn't apply to you. You guys aren't regulated under this. And that's what prompted our request for an advisory opinion, because my approach is, sounds nice, but unless I get official guidance or I have a court case, ideally after I haven't been sued, unless I get one of those, hot air doesn't help me out at all. Okay? So now I understand that post facto statements by legislators really don't have any impact on a legal interpretation of a statute. I recognize that. But I would add it as a data point, certainly within the context of this factual hearing.
Something that may be helpful for the Secretary and your office to look at in terms of that distinction between, particularly when it comes to get out the vote type efforts, is a case involving the Christian Coalition. Al Fried was heading up that group. That they were specifically sued to say, because they had been claiming that they were a 501c4 entity, but because they were so heavily engaged in get out the vote type activities, even if it wasn't related to candidates or even parties by name, they were found to be a Section 527 organization because they did engage in, as a major purpose, influencing or attempting to influence elections. So that's one example of groups that you might normally not think would be subject to all this stuff, but were in fact roped in to the 527 regime as, for tax purposes, treating for that. And that would essentially, that same analysis is going to hold true for many civic oriented organizations that are active in Colorado that probably never dreamed of being subject to this very onerous and burdensome registration reporting issue.
Okay.
Probably every organization has a newsletter of some type. If there's advocacy within the newsletter, how does that, does that fall in?
That would probably be considered a 527. You got to understand one thing. The differences between election law and tax law. In election law, you're not a political committee if you're a membership organization and just communicating among membership. You're
okay.
Not a political committee.
Okay?
Because that's an exemption. Reaching out to your members is exempt from expenditures. However, you're still a 527. You're still a 527 organization. In fact, if you're a candidate committee, a political party, a political committee, small donor committee, you are a 527 organization automatically. You're still a 527 organization.
For tax purposes.
For tax purposes. Now, under the tax code, the IRS says, well, since you're doing all that reporting on the state side, you don't have to report for us. But you're still one of us. You're still a 527. Okay? And that's what people don't understand. The term 527 has two uses. One is the legalistic use, Section 527 organization under the IRS code. That includes a political party, it includes candidate committees, it includes all of these political entities. That's the legal definition of 527. The slang term of a 527 is an election law use, and it's like, well, these new organizations out here are doing stuff, and they're not a political committee, and they're not a small donor committee, and they're not this, and they're not that. What do we call them? Oh, we'll call them a 527. That's what we'll call them. Okay? So there's really sort of a slang use of 527 and the legalistic use of 527. Because we're dealing with a law here, we have to look at the legalistic use of the term 527. So I hope that answers. So a newsletter, you can pass out a newsletter and say, vote for this candidate, or that candidate's good. And if it's just a newsletter to your membership, you are not going to be a political committee under Colorado law, absent other factors. But you are still a 527.
I'm still a little concerned about, you don't have to answer this, but I'm still uncertain about the $25,000 minimum, and it's still unclear to me whether an organization that's under the $25,000 minimum in fact falls under Colorado's law. That seems to be a confusing area, and I were going to look at that. I'm going to leave the rulemaking record open until the close of business on Thursday. If anybody wants to provide additional comment on that, that's great.
I think the operative language is the is exempt or seeks exemption under the IRS code. And if you look at Section 527, you're automatically exempt if you think you're exempt, okay, or even if you might think you're exempt, even if you don't have to do anything. You only have to seek exemption under the code, or technically notify the IRS of exemption under the code, $5,000 or over. Here's my concern. From a practical standpoint, there are plenty of organizations out there. There are a few. I know of one at least that makes its living by filing campaign finance complaints and issuing press releases and all kinds of fun stuff. And usually Republicans are the target of that. And I know there are several activists throughout Colorado who tend to target Republicans as well. This type of ambiguity is an absolute magnet for litigation. The last thing I want to do is go to court and have to defend an organization like this in front of an administrative law judge who may adopt a very strange reasoning, and I believe some judges have done that before. Okay? And now all of a sudden we've got these new standards which are very contorted and very difficult and perhaps very onerous. That's my concern. And even more to the point, that's not just one case. A lot of times it'll be two or three or four cases because a court is focused on the specific issue before it. It's not creating a global rule necessarily. So there's still going to be ambiguities there. I hate being in the position, like I have been with the Colorado Federation, CFRW, I hate being in the position of saying, I don't know, you pays your money, you takes your chances. Okay? And that's the position we're in right now. And, you know, I mean, a court lottery system is just not a good way to regulate First Amendment rights. It's just not. And I think that's really just attracts that type of stuff. You know, we've sought the request for an advisory opinion, and we've sought the rulemaking specifically to avoid this stuff. But you know, someone's going to be on the receiving end. It may be us, or it may be peremptory action against someone else. But it's just not a good way to run a railroad.
Thank you very much. And I'd like to thank everybody for attending and providing your comments. And I am going to leave the rulemaking record open until the close of business on Thursday. So if anyone present or anyone listening, and this is broadcast over the internet, wants to provide additional written comments, I'm inviting that until the close of business on Thursday. You know, I really appreciate everybody being here and providing their comments. I'm troubled by the fact that we don't have others here as well. But nevertheless, there'll at least be the opportunity to hear other points of view if there are some. So with that, I'll go ahead and conclude the hearing. For the record, the time is 3:55 p.m. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.